The Talk Radio Europe Magazine Show with Hannah Murray.
Although actually it's Jilly Revel having such fun with the telephones today, because my next guest is, I'm sure, waiting to speak to us with bated breath, Richard Marsh, who wrote Spanish and Basque legends. But his number is coming up and saying, I don't exist. So we're going to have a lovely little tune from Enrique Iglesias for a couple of minutes while I just rush through to the outer office and shout, help! And we'll see what we can do. Nicole Scherzinger, it's 14 minutes now to two. A digit had been dialed wrongly. My apologise to everyone, in particular to Richard Marsh, who now is hopefully on the right line. Hello, good afternoon to you.
I'm here, yes.
Thank goodness for that. Now, you're in Dublin, I think, yes?
I'm in Dublin, Ireland, yes.
Is it nice and warm there or freezing cold?
No, very cold.
Oh.
Wishing I was where you are.
Well, it's not roasting here, but it is about 18 degrees, I think, so not too bad.
I don't want to hear about it.
Now, your book is fascinating, especially to those of us who live down in the south of Spain. Spanish and Basque legends. Have you written a lot of these kind of guides where you go around talking to locals of countries and get all the local stories?
In 2004, I published a book called The Legends and Lands of Ireland. And 3 years ago, I published a book called Tales of the Wicklow Hills about County Wicklow, just south of Dublin. And it's more or less the same format where I would translate stories, rewrite stories that I found, and go and talk to the local people, take pictures of where the stories happened. And it's a combination of book work, library work, and being on the ground. For example, in the Spanish and Basque legends, where I talk about Covadonga, the cradle of Spain, as it's called, La Cuña, the people who were Pelayo, who started the Reconquista, the reconquest of Spain from the Moors, had his headquarters. And I can say that it is impregnable from the front. You can't get into the cave there except by the modern staircases. So that gives you an idea of the scene when I'm quoting a historian who tells about that battle, Father Juan de Mariana. And you know that it's impregnable. They can't really reach the people in there.
Mm-hmm.
But I was there. I saw the stairs, so I know what it looks like. And so I think that gives an added twist to the stories when I can say what the local people say about the place. For example, the story of Ramiro and Odonza. I went to the town in Portugal. It's a Spanish story, but most of it happened in Portugal. And I went to the town mainly to find out if the people knew their story, and quite often local people don't know their local stories. But I found out that a few years previously, the city had put on an outdoor pageant telling the story. So everybody knows the story. It's a brilliant story. So I really feel that when you're talking about legends, you know, legends are really the history as seen by the people themselves.
What gave you the idea to look at Spanish and sort of Basque regions? Did you speak Spanish or Portuguese?
I don't speak Portuguese, and I translated that one story from Portuguese with the aid of a Portuguese dictionary.
That must have been a good challenge.
But I got it from the best version of it was in Portuguese. There is a version in Spanish, but it left out a few things, so it took me about 3 days to get through the bloody thing.
I mean, some of the stories down here, I've only been down here, well, about 25 years, I guess, ones like the lovers of Antiquera, who fell to their death. Actually, just like to run through that story for some of our listeners who haven't heard it, but they know the area.
Yeah, that the Peña de los Enamorados, a few years ago it was declared a national heritage monument and the most important monument in the province of Malaga.
Mm-hmm.
And it just stands out. I mean, you approach the thing and you see it just rearing up from the plains, from the Vega. And you want to know, what is that? What happened there? And there are two amazing things there. One, if you go into Antiquera and you go to the passage tombs, a couple of passage tombs just outside the city, and if you align yourself with the passage on one of the passage tombs, it is aligned right on the Peña. And the Peña has two peaks, and at the, oh dear, which is it now? It's the sunrise at the winter solstice, I think it is.
Yeah.
The sun appears between those two peaks. So that alignment was done on purpose. And then you want to know, well, something obviously happened there because it's so outstanding. And then you come across this romantic, tragic story of the lovers. It's a very short story. Mariano, in his History of Spain, 1592, he's telling about the siege of Antequera. And sort of as an aside, he says that somebody went as a sentinel there to watch out for an attack. And he tells this story, as it just as an aside, like a footnote. Mm-hmm. And it's a very short story that a young Christian man was captured. He was working as a slave. He was sort of a trustee in the household. Fell in love with the teenage daughter of his master. She fell in love with him. They decided to escape, and off they went. They were chased, and of course they were both going to be killed because this relationship was forbidden. They ran up to the top of the Peña. The father called for crossbowmen to come, and they knew that they were doomed. So they just wrapped their arms around each other and jumped. Mm-hmm. It's a very short, simple story, but it's just so romantic and so tragic. And it's centered on this outstanding spot in the landscape that just jumps out at you.
Yeah.
So that's probably one of the best known stories, I say, in the South, isn't it?
It is indeed. But also, I live personally quite close to Tarifa, where we have Guzman el Bueno.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, how he threw the knife down to the Moors to say, yes, kill my son. I hadn't realized the son actually had been on the side of the Moors trying to attack the castle itself at the time.
Yeah, and I only found that in one source. And I think it's a lovely story, the gesta, the heroic deed of Tarifa.
Yeah.
Where, and I went there. Again, with the purpose, stayed overnight in Tarifa, went there with the purpose of finding out if the local people knew the story. And almost nobody knew the story. I mean, here's the bloody statue standing right in the middle of the square, a huge statue, beautiful statue, with him gripping this dagger, you know, and obviously not brandishing it as if he's going to attack someone. He's holding it by the blade, and he's going to throw it down. And nobody seems to know what it means.
But you also, in your book, say that it's highly likely that actually the son wasn't killed anyway.
The legend is, very briefly, that the Tarifa was besieged by the Moors, and he was the governor of the city. And he was told, surrender the city or we're going to kill your son. They had his son all tied up in a burrow under the walls. And he said, I'm not going to surrender the city. If you're going to kill my son here, use my dagger to do it. And they killed his son. But he didn't surrender the city. And that's why he's a hero. And that's why the king gave him the right to add Guzman el Bueno, Guzman the good, to as a sobriquet. And that is the legend. And in most cases, you don't want to spoil a good story with facts. But in this case, the facts are more interesting. The son was in it. He was a rebel. He was rebelling against his father. He joined the traitorous prince, the brother or son of the king.
Yeah.
And he was in cahoots, and it was probably his idea. And he was not killed. And he lived. And he and his wife were traitors against the king. They rebelled against the king later on. And I think the history of that, the true story of that, is much more fascinating than the legend.
You often wonder, too, what Guzman el Bueno's wife had to say about him chucking a dagger over the sides of the castle, saying, yeah, go and kill him. I don't think she'd have been too amused. Now, you obviously are quite a scholar. Do you actually go back to original sources then to read up all these legends?
My sources for this book and other books, and I'm working on another book about Irish legends too, it's pretty much the same approach. I find the stories usually through relatively modern sources, and I, for copyright reasons and moral reasons, ethical reasons, I don't want to use those, so I might reword them, but I also want to go back to the originals.
Mm-hmm.
And I find the medieval manuscripts. And these come from usually about 13th to the 16th century of Spanish stories. Relatively easy to read. And the same thing with the Irish, the Old and Middle Irish. With a bit of help from a dictionary, they're not that difficult to get into. And you find that a lot of the interesting bits of the stories are missing from the modern versions. And also, a lot of people have questioned whether I should put Spanish and Basque legends into the same book for the obvious political reasons. And I didn't want to write a book of Basque legends only. I felt I wasn't qualified to do that. And there are plenty of versions of Basque legends in Spanish and in English.
Mm-hmm.
There has not been a collection of Spanish legends in English since the 1920s, when Lewis Spence wrote a book that I thought was totally inadequate. The only good one was the 1860s by the American author Washington Irving, who traveled a fair bit around Spain and got these stories from manuscripts and from the people. And his writing cannot be bettered. I quote him in a few places in my book. He was a brilliant writer. Yeah. But to get the real stories, and to get my own versions of the stories, and to get the flavor of the original authors, I go to the manuscripts.
How do you divide your time up? I mean, is it possible to say you like spend a whole year researching with manuscripts and then you take 6 months off to walk around all the venues, or isn't it quite as clear-cut as that?
Not as clear-cut as that, no. I'm a storyteller, and I specialize in Irish stories when I go to Spain especially. I tell stories, Irish stories, in the language schools and other places, but especially the Escuelas Oficiales de Idiomas. Uh-huh. I've been to over 50 of them all around the country. Most recently, the past few years, in the south, in Andalusia. And I tell the stories in English. And while I'm there, I collect the Spanish and Basque stories. Mm. And sometimes I sneak in a few Spanish and Basque stories when I'm telling the Spanish and Basque people. For example, there's a brilliant story, a Basque story, that has an Irish prince as the hero. And I tell that story in the Basque country. And the Basques don't know that story. And it's one of their central stories.
How do they react to you when you're coming out with historical stories from their culture and you're not one of them?
I've traveled all over Spain. I've been to more parts of Spain than most Spanish people. I've been to more parts of Ireland than most Irish people. I'm a tour guide over here, going to places associated with Irish myth and legend. And that's just the way it is. I'm interested. I'm an American. I'm an American citizen. I've only been in Ireland for 30 years now.
So do you have any other areas next then? Perhaps back to America, the Mississippi Delta, and its rumors and stories?
I have very few American stories. I was not a storyteller when I was living in America. Mm. I have very few American stories. There's plenty of American storytellers who tell American stories. There are very few people telling Irish legends. They tell folk tales, but not the legends.
Now, how do you define the difference?
Well, in my introduction, I go through my theory of it. A legend, by definition, is based on fact. It's either a real event that really happened, uh-huh, or a real person. And scraps of migratory international folk tales and folk motifs become attached to these people. For example, Jonathan Swift, right? Everybody knows who Jonathan Swift was. Mm-hmm. He wrote Gulliver's Travels, uh-huh, Mother's Proposal. He was a real person. There are legends around him, told in Dublin. And these stories are probably making up, you know, make believe.
Right.
But a lot of people tell the folk tales, and there are a lot of Spanish folk tales in collections of international folk tales. And these are, I think, pretty well represented. People don't tell the legends. And I find the legends more fascinating because there is this basis of fact. There is certainly a truth in them, a psychological truth in them. Because when you tell a legend, or you perpetuate a legend of your culture, you are telling not only fact, you are telling what that story means to you. You are saying, this is what we are. Hmm. Right? And the fictional part, the making up part, the imagination part, that is part of the truth, the psychological truth in that story.
Do you think there's a risk that you're going to run out of legends to explore and write about?
I don't think so. That's one of the things I like about this. I'm learning new stories all the time. I'm hearing about stories. Why don't I know that story? I should have that story. No, it's an inexhaustible supply.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the program today. Talking of time, we are almost out of it because the 3 o'clock news is looming. But let's just say again, Spanish and Basque Legends, translated and adapted by yourself, Richard Marsh, is certainly available. We have a thing called Book World España, where I know that they are marketing the book. So thank you very much indeed for coming on the program.
Thanks very much for having me.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
So that was Richard back there in Dublin. Any moment now, we'll be going into the news. I expected a little jingle to come up here, but it just hasn't bothered to play itself, so we're simply going to go into the news at the top of the hour, and I will be back with you tomorrow for the last time, for the time being anyway, again doing Hannah's programme then. Bye-bye.